This audio is provided without charge by Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, which reserves all rights. Please visit givewts.com to learn how you can support Westminster or contact communications at wts.edu for more information.
Okay, now back to the lexicon. And this is continuation of the same column. You keep running your way down the page, SQ Act plus M. And then way down the page, the last two lines of the first column, you see that 2A. The point is it's 2. So now you're given some help in organizing these different meanings. There's a 2A, presumably there's a 2B, maybe 2C. But they're all more closely related to one another than to meaning one. All right? Then 2A, SQ-inf, with or without le. So that's telling you not simply about this word, but the construction in which it's used. And you realize it's saying when it's followed by an infinitive construct, all right, will frequently be with le. So that makes sense. Add to do equals do again or more. Notice the italics. And, I mean, these guys, they are into minutiae. This is not italicized. Why not? Because it's not part of the gloss. This is a gloss, do again. It's a possible equivalent. And do more is a possible equivalent. Or is not the equivalent of anything, right? It's just used to distinguish these two possible glosses. So you can see they're being very careful about the use of italics. In hex, that is the hexateuch. That's the Pentateuch plus Joshua. Now, there are certain common features in that group of six, although I think it can be overdone. But there's one of the failings of BDB is that it was written at a time when source criticism and the JEDP, the documentary theory of the Pentateuch, was in its heyday. But you can just ignore that. So don't let it bother you. But they're saying certain words tend to appear in certain literary contexts. Okay, so we'll summarize that. 2A, Hifiel Yasof, plus a optional le, I put it in parentheses, with or without le, plus infinitive with the sense do again. Let's go back to that second column, and you keep running your eye down the page because there's a whole bunch of material. Yeah, this is the top of the second column. Keep running your eye down, and there is a 2B part way down the page here. SQ inf C period. What is that? Followed by the imperfect, and the C is Latin cum, with. Now you say, I don't know Latin. It's okay. Everything is in the list of abbreviations. Just a matter of getting used to it. Followed by the imperfect, with the vav consecutive, okay, of past time, gives you some more verses, but not another gloss. So it's saying it's the same meaning, it's just a different way of expressing the same meaning. And then boldface C, SQ inf ascent. What's that? Followed by the imperfect ascenditon. Ascenditon is the technical label for no conjunction. More often used in Greek than in Hebrew. But it's saying you don't have a vav consecutive. You just have the one stuck directly after the other one. But again, no separate gloss. So you can see why 2A, 2B, and 2C are grouped together, because there's no difference in meaning as far as the writers of the lexicon could see. It's simply three different constructions with slight variations between them that have the same meaning. Okay, so 2B, hefeel plus yafsop plus vav consecutive plus imperfect, do again. And 2C, hefeel yasop plus imperfect, no vav consecutive, do again. Now we're ready for step two. Evaluate. Do the headings represent distinct senses? What do you think? Well, there are four. And there are four distinct ones, right? Are they all distinct? Are some of them distinct? Well, 2A, B, C, grammatically they're distinct, but in meaning they're not. So there are at most two senses. And the writer of this article in the lexicon has usefully grouped it so you could see that. What about these two senses? Are they distinct? Or are they the same large sense? Well, how do you evaluate this? For one thing, there are two distinct grammatical constructions. The one with an accusative plus various prepositions, and the other with an infinitive or imperfect, some verb. So that should make you think, well, maybe this is distinct. And then if you think about rough synonyms for these two meanings, then you can actually come up with a whole series of rough synonyms for the add to, the idea of add to. How else would you express that in English? Well, increase, multiply, make more, whereas the do again, repeat, reiterate, redo, it's a different kind of feel. So this kind of thing, if you can produce two distinct sets of synonyms, it's a good indication that you've got two meanings. Yes, there are two distinct senses. So back to step two. Yes, there are two distinct senses. Step three, decide which sense occurs in 5122 and what grounds do you have for your conclusion. Well, now we have to go back up here. The goblet cup of my wrath, not tosifi, the hefeel, imperfect, lishtota. The le is followed by an infinitive construct, which is the root shata, to drink. Okay? It's exactly the construction described in 2A. Exactly, right? The verb in question, followed by le, followed by infinitive construct, actually with a pronominal suffix. So that's an excellent indication that the grammatical construction is right. In addition, the context, what fits the context? Behold, I have taken from your hand the goblet cup of my wrath and the cup of staggering, not you will again drink her again. Do again is the right thing for the context, okay? It makes sense. Hence, it is that second sense that occurs. All right? It fits the grammar, it fits the context of meaning. Second example. This will be our last one. Isaiah 52:7. We've been going and going. Let's take a break before we do the second exam. Okay, here we go. So a second example is from Isaiah 52. How pleasant or beautiful upon the mountains are, is understood, the feet of the one who brings good news, who publishes shalom, peace, who brings good news of good things, who publishes Yeshua. We're going to focus on this word and its meaning in context. Saying to Zion, your God reigns. All right, so the assignment is to determine the meaning of that one word. We look at the lexicon under Yeshua, and here it is, page 447, and you've got a photocopy of it. The first column, halfway down, Yeshua, NF, noun feminine, salvation, boldface. Now, this is interesting because the organization of this article, this entry, is different. Rather than starting out just with lexical forms and so on, it starts out with this boldface salvation. And now that's already a hint that maybe there's one general meaning that covers the whole thing. So it's worth noting, right, that it starts out that way. It's followed by a whole bunch of forms, and then boldface one, welfare, prosperity in italics. Boldface two, deliverance. Boldface three, salvation by God. But look at this. The italics ends there. So they're helping you to understand, right, what is being talked about here. But the by God is not judged to be included in the sense of the word itself. Primary from external evils, but also with added spiritual idea. Continue on. Well, okay, so we've got those three. So continue on down in the column two of the same page. And you have boldface four, victory. And then C period, Latin cum, with asa. Now, this is worth attending to because it's suggesting that the meaning victory comes not in isolation, but in a particular construction. Okay, so that might be then a distinct meaning that happens to occur only in certain contexts. So to work victory, but then it goes on, there are some other things, work victory and then phrases, various phrases, do victories, store of victories, tower of victories, stronghold of victories, then, you know, this... He's saying, no, it's not really one construction. You know, it's a whole bunch of things. All right? So we certainly want to add that as a fourth meaning, victory. Step two, evaluate. Do the headings represent distinct senses? Well, I already hinted, and it was a hint, I think, in the entry itself, that it started out with this boldface word, salvation. So we should think, are these really distinct meanings? All right, think about it. Deliverance, salvation, and victory are very similar. Victory is deliverance in a situation of war or battle. Salvation, for us in modern English, that often has a theological meaning, so it's deliverance of a spiritual kind, although you can talk about people being rescued or saved from drowning and so on. But salvation, we talk about a person experiencing salvation when they're saved from drowning. So these three are actually pretty similar. And if you try, well, before we get any further, and then the fourth one is welfare. And that, too, is somewhat similar because deliverance, the main thing about it that makes it different is deliverance moves you from one situation, a situation of threat or distress of some kind, to another situation of having been delivered, right? Of you're free from the threat or distress. And welfare and prosperity, rather than describing the process of moving from one state to another, describes the state that you end up in. In addition, if you look in the lexicon, you see that there is only one verse given, namely from Job, that has this meaning. Well, when there's only one verse, it's a little more difficult to discern, is this really deliverance with a focus on the final state rather than a completely distinct idea of welfare or prosperity that has nothing to do with being delivered from some problem. So my judgment is there's probably only one broad meaning, deliverance. Salvation is spiritual deliverance, victory is deliverance in war, welfare is deliverance with emphasis on where you get, okay? So the answer is no, there are not distinct senses. Step three, decide which of the senses occur in Isaiah 52, and the answer is deliverance. There's no decision necessary. Now, technically, because you're talking about a situation in context of God bringing it, so it does have spiritual overtones, so you could translate it, salvation, right? But it's not because that particular word, Yeshua, is already of necessity set pushing you in a spiritual direction. It's because the whole context tells you this is spiritual deliverance, right? So if you want to translate it salvation, that's okay. But the point is, it's not a decision you make on the basis of we have four meanings and we must choose accurately which of these and not the others is evoked in this particular context. It's rather no choice necessary. Okay, so let's make the point negatively by saying what false inferences might people want to draw. Consider the following reasoning. Yasha, that root, has the root meaning be capacious. Hence, Isaiah 52:7 means that God's salvation gives us wide room for our souls. What do you think of that? Well, there should be flags that pop up in your mind when you read something like that. Beware of appeals to root meaning. Frequently, this is kind of an etymological thing. And it is true that the Hebrew triliteral roots, there are some fascinating commonalities between the different meanings that belong to different nouns and verbs that are related to those roots and to different stems of the verbs and so on. But it's very tempting to exaggerate the relationships, if any, between those senses. Words over time develop distinctive meanings that belong to these distinctive stems. So that root meaning, in effect, a kind of etymological meaning, is not necessarily a good guide to contemporary meaning. And beware of importing other passages. Well, does God's salvation give us wide room for our souls? There are passages in the Psalms where David talks about you given a wide place for my steps under me. Well, if you want to teach that God gives wide room for our souls, start with a passage like that. Of course, it's talking more physical deliverance, but then that can be an analogy to spiritual deliverance. But at least you're in the ballpark, right? Go to a passage which actually does that rather than to a passage which is actually not about that. It's about salvation, to be sure, but not about being capacious. Deliverance. Stick with the lexicon. Okay, now, homework exercises. I want to assign homework. This is Wednesday, so it'll be due Friday. And let me pass out a worksheet. This worksheet is in your syllabus. But many of you maybe will not want to tear your syllabus out and lose another page and that kind of thing. So I've provided with a separate sheet that you can turn in, all right? It's the same sheet.
I just had a quick question about these past two examples.
Yeah.
I believe that the more I study both Greek and Hebrew, I believe that as opposed to English, which is carried by its vocabulary, it seems to me that Greek is carried by the grammar and the syntax, whereas Hebrew is carried by the context. Is it?
Well, all three are all three. Yeah, inevitably, you have to have an interaction of all three in all three languages. It may seem to be that way. It's true, for instance, that Greek syntax is much more complicated than Hebrew, and that Hebrew will spread things out, although it can be, you know, in proverbs and in poetry, things can be very compressed. So it's difficult to, you know, make generalizations stick. And English, modern English style prefers simple sentences, even though we can make huge sentences if we want, but, you know, most people don't. Okay, here's the homework. I want you to start with this sheet, and it's essentially a worksheet of this same kind. And what I want you to do is to fill it out, the three steps. It shouldn't take you, I hope for many of you, it will take 20 minutes. But if it's over 45 minutes, get somebody else to talk to or even phone me up, because the point is not to spend a lot of time, but it's to just to do something that will confirm what we've been talking about. Do the three steps using Brown, Driver, and Briggs. And somebody asked me in the break, what about Halliday? And the answer is, yeah. You know, there are these convenient and the lexicons, like the for Greek, the lexicon that's in the back of some of the UBS New Testaments. They're just very short lexicons, very convenient for the student who just doesn't remember or hasn't learned the meaning of some word, right? So you just look it up and then you go on. But if you're doing careful study, in particular, if there's some dispute, then you want maximal information. And that is your Bauer for the New Testament and BDB for the Old. So I want you to use BDB for this. Whether you own it or not, there's plenty of copies on in the reference section. But it's cheap. Copyright is expired, so why not buy it? You know. So determine the sense of asif chem in Isaiah 52:12. That's your assignment. Go through the three steps, and then at the bottom of the page, I've given you a little extra challenge of what you think of a claim that somebody makes with respect to this passage. Fill out the attached worksheet, respond to the sample reasoning near the bottom of the page, and optionally, you can do a second one, and I'll pass that out too. This really is optional. You will get no more points. But if you are at all feeling insecure about this whole business of word meanings, this is an extra chance not only to do something, but then to have a greater look it over. And I will discuss it in class, too, on Friday. But if you do the one that is required, the one on Isaiah 52:12, and you feel you say, this is easy, I have no problems, then, you know, don't feel you need to do the second one. But the second one is determine the meaning of hamartias in John 8:46. And as I say, we'll discuss both of those in class. Okay. So, final summary, to sort of draw all this together. What are the principles to be aware of for these three steps? What alternative senses are there? Look at an advanced lexicon, the standard lexicon, I'm saying, not a learner's lexicon like Halliday or the thing in back of the UBS New Testament. Are the senses distinct? Where you're looking for distinct, as it were, areas of meaning. And let me give you a little more information about how to do that. So here's a guy who looks at these entries in the lexicon and is trying to decide whether there are distinct meanings. If there are, you pick the one sense that is appropriate to context. If there are not, then there's no need, right? It's all one broad sense. But how do you know? And oh yeah, when you're picking one sense, you look at the list of different senses in the lexicon and you pick one, not more, okay? Based on the grammatical construction, based on the topic, based on the whole context. When are the senses distinct? Well, do you think that intuitively, do they seem distinct? Many people's intuitions are pretty good at this, but if you want some further refinement, I'd suggest you ask whether they overlap. For instance, with the deliverance and salvation thing. Well, salvation is spiritual deliverance, so it's clearly a lot of overlap between those. If you can find intermediate cases as you go through the examples, then you find, okay, I can't clearly distinguish these. Are there two different sets of synonyms? If there are, probably two distinct senses. If you find it very difficult to make two sets of synonyms, it probably means that that's all one broad sense. Two grammatical or semantic contexts, for instance, set a price on, monetary context, honor, personal context, personal relations, right? Two very different contexts lead to those meanings. Using a concordance to find word meaning, should you do it? How do you do it? Well, my basic response on this is that Brown-Driver-Briggs for the Old Testament and Bauer for the New Testament have already done that for you. They had concordances, the people who wrote this, plus this sort of fanatical technical specialization of, you know, being really interested in lexical detail. They've done it for you. And if you do, however, go through a concordance, looking at every instance and trying to discern what are the various meanings, you should watch for whether there are distinct grammatical constructions that belong, that go together with distinct meanings. But as we've seen with some of these cases, the lexicons themselves notice this kind of thing, right? If you read them carefully, they show you what kinds of meanings go together with what kinds of constructions. You watch for special semantic context and cases maybe that combine or overlap two meanings. So my advice is generally don't worry about doing concordance. You can't do it. You probably won't do it as well as the lexicons have already done it. But if you have some question of saying, well, can I find an intermediate case or so on, you might, you know, look through all the cases where a certain meaning occur, a certain word occurs, and see whether you find intermediate cases. Okay, one final thing, and that's about how we conceptualize our thinking about word meanings. Word meanings, there's something about this which gets people prone to errors. And so I want to help you conceptualizing it using, first of all, an example that doesn't come from word meaning so much as thinking about Noah's family and introducing three interlocking perspectives on Noah's family. identity variation distribution. And the identity is also contrast between Noah's family and other families. So the identity is, look, it's Noah's family we're talking about, right, versus other families, contrast. Variation is that members vary in age, sex, gifts, and so on. And of course, people are born, they would be added to the family, or wives as the sons of Noah marry. So there can be variation in the number of people in the family. And distribution, they live in an environment on land, and then, of course, during the flood, they live in the ark, and they live with animals in the ark, and so on. So that's what I mean by those three things: identity, variation, distribution. And the identity is also partly a contrast. Now look at the meaning. Now we're getting into word meanings. The meaning of the word horse, all right? So horse contrasts with other animals. Variation. Horse varies in type, age, and so on. There's breeds of horses, right? And we're probably talking about domestic horse rather than a wild horse. And distribution. Horses live, jump, eat, but do not speak or worship. So this word horse will occur in certain characteristic contexts and not in others. So we've got these three features: identity, variation, and distribution. And they go together. They operate together. They're all three present simultaneously. And if you try to define identity, the identity even of a particular word, you will use variation and distribution. They're just inseparable. But when we use these three things together, we're also rejecting some other ideas which are one-sided or even incorrect in their most exaggerated form. In talking about identity, that can be idealized into the idea of purely general categories. And it's associated in the history of philosophy with a philosophy called realism, which said that general abstract categories were real. In fact, in many forms of realism, they were regarded as more ultimate metaphysically than the particular examples. Now, I mean, that sounds very abstract, but you start, in effect, with the concept of horse or with horseness. And that's a real category, maybe in the mind of God, or if you're a Platonist, it's an abstract category that is then embodied in particular horses, right? So the category is prior to the embodiments. You start with pure general categories. That's philosophical realism. If you emphasize variation and only variation, you end up with pure particulars. That is, the medieval theory is called nominalism, where words like horse are names for a grouping which we create in our minds. So in fact, they're just individuals out there, right? And then we create the general category. It doesn't exist except in our minds. It's merely a name. So that tends to undermine the unity, say, among the horses. And well, you people interested in presuppositional apologetics can probably see that the tendency here is the priority of the one over the many, and here's the priority of the many over the one. And Van Til says, no, right? They're equally ultimate and actually in the end go back to the Trinity. And the third area, distribution, if exaggerated, leads to pure relations. And that was not part of medieval philosophy, but it's something close to it has appeared in 20th century kind of philosophy, structuralism, which reduces the world to relationships. So there's nothing but relationships. No entities, but only relations. And my approach here, which, yeah, it does go back to the Van Til and the one and the many and Trinitarian character of God, but I'm not going to go into all the details about that. My approach to word meanings is to reject all three of these philosophical, kind of one-sided, exaggerated views, and to say, no, these three things, the identity, the variation, and the contribution, belong together in the meaning of words, but also then in the way that God created the world. So I recommend that as a way of conceptualizing that responds to what we've already seen in terms of we can distinguish senses, but even when we can distinguish senses, there's often some commonality between them. So there you have a one and many, right? Or when there's one broad sense, then you could still distinguish different areas of use, right? So there again, you've got variation within an overall unity. So those things should not feel upset by that. It's part of the gift of language that God has given us that words operate this way. Here's some errors to avoid, all right? So there's a positive conceptualization. Here's a summary of what to avoid. Etymologizing. We already went through this with the word nice in English, all right? Does it mean ignorant just because etymologically it can be traced back to the word nescius in Latin? No, no, no. Etymology does not furnish meaning. There are occasions when people use it with rare words in Hebrew because they've got nothing better. Although they do have context. Even if a word only occurs once in the whole Hebrew Bible, you look at the context and you can sometimes make a guess. But if it's a rare word, it may be a specialized word so that your guess is a little more guessy, if I could put it that way. So when you have no better resource, okay, you know, fall back on that, but it's not at all ideal. It suggests a guess. The second error to be avoided is the idea of holy language. Is the Bible's language odd? The entire Bible is holy. It is the very speech of God. So it is holy, but what does its holiness consist in? Does it consist in a kind of oddity, a kind of weirdness? Well, think of the tabernacle as an example. The tabernacle is a holy structure by appointment of God himself. But the language describing the construction of the tabernacle is pretty normal and ordinary, right? And it itself, that language is holy, but it's not because it's unintelligible or that it's weird. In fact, Bezalel and the other people involved had to understand it, right? It had to be ordinary in a kind of meaning sense in order for them to understand it and to construct the tabernacle in the way that God wanted. So holiness is not equivalent to weirdness. And I think sometimes people get confused about that. God's word is holy, but its holiness is related to its purity and its authority, obviously, too, not to weirdness. Okay, next error is the idea of one central meaning. The idea here is that there must be always a deep unity. It emphasizes identity and ignores variation, in effect. There must be a deep identity, which is the real thing, right? It's related to the philosophy of realism. And here's an example of one rather foolish use of this idea of deep identity. Some Jews argued on the basis of these verses that uses the same word for foolish woman. Job 2:10, Job says, you're speaking like a foolish woman, because his wife had just told him, just curse God and die. And the same word occurs in Genesis 34:7 concerning the treatment of Dinah. So some of the rabbis said, Job married Dinah. There must be a deep unity here. Well, that's absurd. Another temptation that comes along with the stress of some kind of there must be some deep unity is what James Barr calls illegitimate totality transfer. That means take all the meanings of a single word, take all the meanings that come from all the contexts, and add them all together and pour them into a single verse. Now, I hate to say it, but Amplified Bible is essentially that kind of thing. I mean, not to a huge degree, but it tends to load up, collect the meanings that belong to all the words, all the meanings that belong to a word, and load them up in one context. Don't load all the senses into a single occurrence. But it feels richer, but it's inaccurate, as we have seen. So pistis, for instance, can mean faithfulness, can mean oath, can mean proof, can mean trust, can mean body of doctrine. Do you wrap all those things together and say, I've got all this in this rich, rich word? No, pick one that is appropriate to whatever context you're looking at. Okay, the opposite error, the nominalistic error, is to treat words as having so many isolated islands of meaning, in the sense now there's no unity. Everything falls apart into particulars. And so here we have Sarah, Ruth, Hannah, Mary, all of which actually were women who had, who were able to have children after struggles or challenges of various kinds. And do we say, there's no, the unity is only the name, all right? They're all women. We use the same name, but there's no underlying unity. Well, there are some thematic connections there. So don't just isolate them. And then finally, with listing all these errors or dangers, Aristotle and the syllogism. And I feel a little bit reluctant in going into this because I tend to think we've become an illogical age, and maybe people need to be urged to use more tight logical reasoning. But there are always a few people, at least, who are so fascinated by formal logic that they feel this is all important in theology. And I want to deflate that a little bit by talking about the role of logic in theological reasoning. Here's an example of a formal syllogism. It's a formal logical pattern. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man, hence Socrates is mortal. That is recognized by logicians as being a valid syllogism. That is, if the first two lines of premises are true, then the second one is automatically true. It's a valid syllogism. Here's another one. All bows are weapons. A two-looped slip knot is a bow. That's a kind of bow you tie in a shoe. Hence, a two-looped slip knot is a weapon. What's the matter with that? It's the same exact form as the first syllogism up top. But the problem is that there's an equivocation in the word bow. Right? This bow is the bow and arrow, and this one is the knot bow. And so the conclusion is invalid due to equivocation. Yes, you haven't got the same meaning of the word. Okay, we're going to be out of time, but let you think about this. All believers are justified. I am a believer, hence I am justified. Now that's the same syllogistic pattern. But is there an equivocation with believer? If there is, it destroys the validity of the syllogism. Now the difficulty is, this is a real theological issue because it's related to assurance of salvation, right? And assurance of our being able to stand at the last judgment. You are a believer, but are you a believer in the appropriate sense of the word? And the fact is that we have to look at, well, what does this mean? I'll come back to it next time.
Thank you for listening. For more information about how you can help Westminster continue to provide content like this without charge, please visit givewts.com or email us at communications@wts.edu.